Hi, my name is Bill Hostler, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here, and I can see I'm going to spend most of the evening trying to explain by introduction. I do live on a small boat in the Back Bay of Newport, and it's not because of my great wealth that I live on that small boat, but I have a happy life today. And I want to thank everyone for inviting me to this convention. I'm having a very fine time. I want to thank Click and Wilma for picking me up at the airport, and Ike and Roz for being my host and hostess, and everyone else who's been so nice to be here. I've never seen such a friendly group of people, and it sure makes me feel at home. It's amazing that you can jump on an airplane and come this far and feel so much at home and realize that this is just another extension of the family, and this is the Omaha family, and I'm sure glad to meet you all. I'd like to explain also, for the benefit of the newcomers, that I am not an authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know anything about alcoholism other than my own story. What I am an authority on is stark raving terror. And that's something that I am realizing tonight one more time. But the fact that I was able to come here at all shows that there has been some progress, because after 27 years of drinking, the last few years of which I also added drugs to my daily routine, I was unable to go anywhere. I'd had a surrender, and that surrender was my central nervous system gave up. And it wouldn't go anywhere. And I lived in a bedroom, all locked up in a house, and there was a sign in the front door, and it said, "Do not knock, illness in the household." And that was true, and I had the phone unplugged, and I couldn't go to a grocery store. So the fact that I'm able to now travel as far as Omaha and take an airplane is a miracle in itself, and I have to thank my sponsor for that. My sponsor is here with me tonight, and I never dreamed I would be able to get on an airplane sober. I never dreamed I could get into a grocery store sober, let alone an airplane. But my sponsor's helped me with these fears, and he said that I really did not have a fear of flying. I merely had a fear of crashing and burning. So I thought, well, as long as that's cleared up, I guess it's it's no problem. But when I first showed up, I was asked to read chapter 5 one night, and I said, "I can't do that." And people said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, because I will just pass out at the podium." And I was told that everybody would love it. And then I knew I was going to have problems, that I was going to have to do things and get out and try to be a part of society again. I was at another convention last year, and I had dinner with some other people there, and this lady and I were laughing because the hostess and another waiter both had a sign on, and it gave their name, and it said, "In training." And I said, "You know, I would like one of those badges, because I'd like people to know that I'm in training. I'm still trying to learn how to do things, like take airplane trips and read Chapter 5 and go places." And I said, "I think people would be a lot more tolerant if they knew that I had not had a lifetime of learning how to do these things. This had all happened since I stopped drinking." So one of these girls sent me a badge in the mail. It had my name, and it said, "In training." Underneath it, and I almost wore that tonight, because that's the way I feel about doing these things. I am having some trouble now just trying to learn how to lead a normal life. But I knew that there would be hope after I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because one of the first things someone told me to do was to read the big book. And they said, "Pay attention to the stories in the back of the book. You may find someone that tells your story." And I read the ninth story in the back of the book, and that was The Man Who Mastered Fear. And I read that, and I thought, for heaven's sakes, there's someone else in this world that has had the same problems I have. And I read about the difficulties he had trying to walk around his block because he was paralyzed with fear. And I knew that I wasn't totally unique. When I first arrived here, I thought I was extremely unique. I didn't know there was anyone else that ever felt the way that I did or had the fear that I did. But I've learned as time goes by that I'm not unique, and there are things that I can do. I also, just a short time ago, identified with someone else in addition to the man who overcame his fear, and that was, I went to a play called Are You Lonesome Tonight? It was identified with the title to begin with, but it was a play revolving around the last night of Elvis Presley's life, and I never dreamed that I would identify with Elvis Presley. I do not sing, I don't play a guitar, but in this play, Elvis Presley expressed his feelings, and there were continual flashbacks into his life as it had taken place from the time he was a child. And as I got absorbed in the play, I realized that even though our backgrounds were extremely different, our feelings were identical. And at the time he was born, he had a brother who died, which I hadn't realized. And he had gone through life feeling guilty about that. And there was a part of the household that was missing. In fact, his mother even left an empty seat at the table each night for his brother that was not there. And when I was 4 years old, my seven-year-old brother died. And there was always an emptiness in our household for that same reason. And somehow I always felt guilty about that. And I didn't know anyone else had ever felt that way until I heard the man playing Elvis Presley refer to that. And then as he went on, he told about the difficulties that he got into and the fear that he had and the fact that he had found one thing that helped him overcome the fear and the feelings of guilt and remorse, and that was, of course, drinking, and that was his solution. And later on, he used a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. And the problem that he had was that finally those things had stopped working. And in this play, he was 42 years old, the last night of his life, and he could not find any way to be comfortable, no matter what condition that he was in. And I knew exactly where he was, because when I was 42 years old, I felt the same way. I'd had a lifetime of trying to feel comfortable, of trying to get over guilt and remorse, trying to overcome this terrible fear, and all of a sudden the chemicals I'd been using stopped working, and I was terrified all the time, and nothing I did would help. But when I heard Elvis talking about these problems, and he never intended to be a bad person, and he knew that if he just had spent enough money on different people that everything would be okay, and he bought three airplanes, and he had two volleyball courts that cost $150,000, and all these different things, but nothing had made it all right, and he just had the feeling that everybody that was around him because he'd had some money. And the poor man just was in such pain at this very end in the play. Before the play was over, it's a good thing that I was with some friends who could have restrained me, because I was about to rush up on the stage, grab him, and say, "Elvis, you don't have to feel like that anymore. You don't have to live like this. There's a meeting right down the street. Hurry up before it's too late." And that was just the feeling I had. And I left the play, which I'd gone to because someone else wanted to see it, and I was so glad that I had seen it, because I had such an understanding for Elvis and a greater understanding for myself. But I just thought, what a miracle. At 42 years of age, it was necessary for that very talented young man to die. And a couple of years after I was that age, I was able to find a way of life in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I know that he would enjoy if he had only found that way of life. And today I'm still trying to lead a happy life when I'm breathing on a fairly regular basis and not hyperventilating quite as much. I'm trying to do some other things. And Tom, my sponsor, said that there was one thing he absolutely required of everybody that he sponsored, and that was that they had to lead happy lives. And I thought, well, that's very unreasonable. I didn't see I'd ever be able to do that. But I've learned that there are 12 steps that help you lead a happy life, and that just simply not drinking was not adequate. And it was kind of that very old story that I told a doctor. I had an operation a few years ago, and I asked the doctor if I would be active afterwards, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you this, in a couple months, you'll be back playing golf like a champion." And I came up with a very old line. I said, "That's amazing, doctor, because I could never play golf before." And it's kind of the same way about not drinking. I was never happy before, so I don't know why I would think that simply not drinking would make me happy. And I was told that there were other things that I could do. And I had to examine my life at that time. And one thing that occurred to me when I got sober, I was 45, and I realized that everybody else had a wife. And I didn't. And that made me feel kind of uncomfortable. I had not intended to do that. I just had never gotten around to getting married. And in fact, my story really is not very exciting. Actually, even at the height of my drinking, I'm so envious of people who went these exciting places, and they always seem to end up waking up with strange women. I woke up with strange magazines. I mean, you know, that's that's the story of my life. And but every so often I get worried about that. And one day I was on Balboa Island, and I noticed everybody came in couples. There was not a single person anywhere, and everybody was walking around with a wife and children, or in my case, they were running around with a wife and grandchildren. But I just thought, why is it that this is happening and I'm all alone? And I went back to my little boat in the back bay, where I usually do not feel lonely, and I was very lonely, and I thought there's something wrong with me one more time. And I called up a friend in Laguna, Pat, and I said, "Pat, why is it that every single person in the world has a wife and family except me? And he said, it's because you never got married. So, you know, that I was so glad that someone explained that. So I thought about that from time to time. The man who overcame fear did get married. In the big book, I noticed he had been married long before, and finally, after many years of not being married, he not only overcame his fear of going outside, but he overcame his fear of getting married and having to share with someone else. And I read that and thought, well, maybe that's going to happen to me. And I was kind of interested because I talked to a gal, Jackie, whom I've known since junior high school, and she recently went through a divorce. Told me she was looking for a new husband. And I said, what sort of husband are you looking for? And she said, well, at her age, she was no longer looking for Mr. Perfect. She was looking for Mr. Adequate. I thought, well, here I am in trouble again. Today there is hope, and I know that things are going to work out. And I have hope today, which I really didn't have before. So, but I don't know when I started feeling so different or so guilty. I've gone through life with guilt. I don't know whether it was just because my brother died when I was young. But I know a gal in our group who said in a vague way she still feels responsible for World War II. And I knew what she was talking about because I've always had that feeling that I'm trying to overcome. But my parents were not mean to me at all. We lived in a comfortable household, and I'm sure my parents loved me very much. We did not communicate. The way that we showed affection was by shaking hands. I don't recall that my parents ever told me that they loved me, and I don't think I ever told them. The things like that were very personal, and we didn't talk about personal things in our household. I was told not to talk about personal things with anybody, particularly the neighbors or someone at school. So I went all through schools telling everybody everything was fine. And the only person I ever shared with all through school was our Irish setter. And I could trust him. I learned from him the meaning of unconditional love, because no matter what had happened to me that day, he would wag his tail and be happy to see me. So I kept in constant contact with him when I came home, and I told him the terrible things that had happened, and he understood. And that was my friend. I also protected him. One night, my folks had gone into the kitchen, and my mother had just put a roast beef on the dining room table, which my dad was about to carve, but they were both in the other room, and I walked in the dining room in time to see Terry running out with a roast beef in his mouth. So we kind of wrestled on the floor for a few minutes. I grabbed the roast beef, ran back, put it on the table again. My dad started cutting it and looked and said, I think it's a little overdone. It's coming apart. But I didn't say a word. I thought, you know, Terry never tells on me. I'm not going to tell on him. We just... So that was the way I got through school. I had no idea about alcoholism. My folks did not drink, not to any excess, but on the other hand, my mother's brother drank constantly. My uncle was basically the town drunk, and we lived in Los Angeles. But he was always in the paper. He would have head-on collisions. He had head-on collisions with two cars at once. He was always doing something. He ended up in sanitariums and the jails, and he was kind of a family disgrace. When I was still in high school, he died of an overdose of drugs and alcohol one night, and it was a very lonely end for him. When we had a funeral, despite the fact he had lived in Hollywood all of his life, no one came to his funeral, just a few close family members. And we had to explain to my grandmother that we had asked to have the services private. And we did not want to tell her that of all these friends that he seemed to have in bars all around Hollywood, no one got around to even coming to his funeral. And I knew from that I never wanted to drink. He did not make any sort of a case for drinking, and I thought, I'm going to go through life without ever taking a drink. I just did not want to be like that. But nevertheless, if I had thought that drinking would have made me feel better, boy, I sure would have done it immediately, but I had no idea that it would. But I just kept feeling very, very uncomfortable. And Tom and I were talking about photographs from school, and I found some photographs taken when I was in the second grade. And somebody else was looking at them one day, and he looked at all these kids, and he said, which one of these kids are you? And I didn't even look at the photograph. I automatically said, well, I'm the ugly little kid. And he looked, and he said, Bill, they're all ugly little kids. And I looked, and sure enough, they were. And that was The first time I really realized I did look like all the other kids. The only way I could recognize myself, I was wearing a raincoat, which my mother required me to do from about October until June. Aside from that, I would not have known that I was that person. Something else happened in school, though, and that was that I didn't participate in gym class. The first few years that I went to school, because my brother had been ill for a year and had died, my folks kept sending notes that I was not able to participate in anything. And so I just went through school realizing that I couldn't. And finally, when I did have to play kickball and later softball and basketball, I just couldn't do anything. And I didn't realize that it was because I was so enormously self-conscious. I have had that problem ever since I was a little child. And that was something else that I was told when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I've always been extremely self-conscious and I've had an ego problem. And I said, how could anyone who has such a low opinion of himself have an ego problem? And I was told, to have an ego problem, you don't have to think highly of yourself, you just have to think frequently of yourself. And I guess that's what happened to me in school. And whenever I did get on a team in softball, they always put me out at right field, and everybody automatically hit the ball to right field. And I just stood there, and this little voice kept saying, you're going to drop it. You're going to drop it. And every time I dropped the darn ball, and the little voice said, I told you so. And I knew that everybody realized how terrible I was in sports, and I was just humiliated by that. I felt awful. And the only thing that could have been worse, I guess, was that my folks told me it was time to start dating. And that was really upsetting. But I polished up my 1934 Plymouth, and I asked a girl if she would like to go out and have dinner and go to a movie, and she said she would. So I went to pick her up, and her father said he'd like to have a talk first. So I went into his den, we sat down, and we had a very serious talk, and he said, Bill, I trust you, and I trust Ruth, and I know your family, and I know everything's going to be fine, and I'm not worried, but I do want to make one thing perfectly clear. That is, Ruth has to be home by 1 o'clock. And I thought, that lucky Ruth, because I had to be home at 11. So that's just the way my school life was. And some lady came and spoke at school one day and said, remember, children, these are the happiest days of your life. And I thought, oh, no, it's going to get worse. To this day, when I see children in school and they tell me that they're having a difficult time, I say, don't worry, it gets better, you know, because I would have hated to think that that's the way it was always going to be. But it got better. I got to college, and I loved college. It was just great. We didn't have gym class. And my freshman year, I was selected the worst-dressed freshman, which I was very happy about. There was some stiff competition, and I had moved away from home, and I met another group of people, and I lived in a student house, and the fellow next to me was my hero, because he had been through the Air Force, he had 4 years in the service and had come back to school, and he was now a senior, ready to graduate, and he was very sophisticated, and he was a man of the world. And he also had a lady friend, and she used to come on rare occasions and spend the night in this dormitory or student house, which was an unusual thing at that time. And one night I was next door, and in the middle of the night I heard someone pounding on the door and pounding on the door, screaming something about his daughter being there. Well, I was pretty naive, but I didn't think my neighbor wanted to talk to him right then, so I went out in the hall and asked if I could be of help, and he said, well, yes, I'm looking for Mr. So-and-so. And I said, gee, I'm very sorry, but he's on a biology field trip this weekend, which was as accurate as I could be right then. And, so he said, oh, I'm sorry, I made a terrible mistake. And I didn't see him again until a wedding in June. But I saw my neighbor the next day, and he came over that afternoon, and he said, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you helped me out last night. And even though you're a freshman, I'd like you to come to my room and have a drink. And I don't know if most people remember their first drink, but I remember mine. That's the first time I ever had a drink. He said, well, won't you come in? And here he had a bar all set up, and he said, what would you have? And I started a pattern that I've continued all during my drinking life. I really didn't care. I just said, well, I'll have whatever you're having. I was really never that particular. And so he poured me a drink, and whatever it was just fine. And I felt like finally I had someone that I was equal with, and we had a little secret in common, and I thought, I've got a friend here. And he said, would you care for another one? And once again, I started another pattern. I said, I believe I will, thank you. And And all of a sudden, I just felt like everything was all right for that particular moment. And then things got better because I learned that I could drink beer faster than anyone else in the freshman class. So we would have chug-a-lug contests, and our student house would challenge other ones, and we would chug-a-lug beer out of mugs, and I was always the first one finished, and everybody would cheer, and we would all get roaring drunk and fall down and laugh, and it's the only athletic event at which I've ever excelled. So I enjoyed college, and getting away from gym class was such a relief. I had sworn when I got to college and found out how wonderful it was not going to gym class that I would never step foot in a gym again. And I kept that promise until a couple years ago. And I had a friend in Laguna who realized I was trying to lose a little weight and feel better. And he said, you know, I go to a gym every morning. Why don't you come down to this gym? And there are Nautilus machines that you can work out on. And you'll really enjoy it. And I said, I'm not going in a gym. Are you crazy? And he said, well, if you go early in the morning, everybody there is an AA because no one else gets up that early. And so I tried it out of curiosity. Sure enough, I knew all the people. So I joined a gym, and I started doing that, which I still do. And I made an amazing discovery, and that is a couple hours after doing that, I just felt great. I felt lively, and I had a little bit of a bounce in my step. I didn't know gym class would make you feel good. If I had known that, I would have been more interested. But I still had some problems, though, I guess being self-conscious. One of the things is that this is a co-ed gym, and every time I walked away from a Nautilus machine, it seemed like an 85-pound girl would walk up and double the weight before she used it. So I'm learning to cope with the world a little better today. Now I double the weight before I walk away. So that's my college career. I really did enjoy college without gym class. In fact, I stayed 8 years. I did not want to leave. The unfortunate thing is that I finally left and got in the outside world, and I didn't know what to do. I had received a degree in law, so I decided I would take the California State Bar, which I did, and I passed it, and then I didn't know what to do. I knew that I couldn't practice law. At that time, I didn't know it was tremendous fear. Someone who has a fear of going into grocery stores, which I was sort of fearful of at that time, certainly would have a fear of going into a courtroom, and I think that's probably what prevented me from doing that. Instead, I still wanted to party. I wanted to go chug-a-lug beer, and I would call my old college friends, and I'd say, hey, why don't we go out and get rip-roaring drunk? And they would say, Bill, you don't understand. We've got Little League tonight. We're playing bridge. This is PTA. We don't do that anymore. And everybody else seemed to develop some manner of living, which I didn't understand. And they all ended up in station wagons with wives and camel's hair coats and golden retrievers in the back. And there I was still looking around for someone to chug-a-lug beer with. So I felt miserable. I thought the whole world is like gym class. The only thing was that gave me any hope at all was that I not only had an uncle who drank all the time, I had an uncle who went boating all the time. And I thought, I remembered that boating was a lot of fun, and so I bought a boat, and I moved on board, and you can see how much progress I made. I'm still living on a boat today. But at that time, that boat was an escape. It's no longer an escape for me today. As a matter of fact, we have a roaming men's stag meeting that meets at a different house once a month, and each year, one of the times, it meets on my boat. So having the boat open to AA meetings is a lot different from just going down to a boat and hiding. But that's what I did. Every night I would just get away from the world, and I would close the hatch, and I would go below and think, oh, thank goodness, I'm away from all of them. During the day, I bought old buildings, and I bought old buildings and repaired them, which was fun. And I discovered buying old buildings and repairing them was profitable. So I started earning money doing that, and I was surviving well financially, but in no other way. I certainly was not surviving well emotionally. I kept feeling more and more different. And I would go around working on these apartments, and I would notice that there were happy families, and everybody seemed to be having a good time. And they would see me driving around in San Pedro, where I was doing this, a little coastal harbor town. And I had a Packard Roadster at that time, and I drove around in the Packard Roadster with the top down, and I was wearing a T-shirt, a straw hat, shorts, had no shoes on, and I had a dog in the rumble seat. And everybody said, there goes Bill, the most carefree person in the whole town. And he's so lucky. He's got those apartment buildings. He's living on a nice boat. He hasn't got a care in the world. And I kept saying, oh, gosh, everything is just wonderful. And then I would go down to the boat that night, and I would close the hatch cover. I'd have a few drinks, and I'd write my first suicide note of the evening. Now, I don't know how many people edit their suicide notes, I know one person who always corrects the spelling, but I would edit it, and then I would read it over, and I would think, well, you know, the message is there, but the sentence structure is weak. And so I would do it over again. And I think, truthfully, I think that there was something more than trying to get the perfect note that kept me from killing myself. I think I thought it would hurt. But I didn't know what else to do. And I just kept drinking, and people would come down on the weekend, and we would all have a wonderful time. Some of my friends were starting to have difficulties. I lost a couple of friends who had fallen overboard on the way back from the bar and drowned, and that had not happened to me. Another friend is still paralyzed from rolling his car down a cliff coming back from a bar one night. But I just thought those were very unfortunate accidents. I had not in any way associated that with the fact that we were all drinking a great deal. And I don't know what kept me alive during that period, except that I never got very far. I kept thinking that I was going to sail off to the South Seas. And as soon as I got to the South Seas, everything would be all right. I would find a sandy little beach with palm trees, and everything would be all right. I would feel comfortable, and then my world would be together. And so I told everybody that I was just getting the boat ready, and eventually I was going to take this long trip. Well, I kept getting the boat more and more ready, and I kept getting more and more unready, and I just never made it past Catalina Island. And I had trouble navigating there. It's 22 miles from San Pedro, and sometimes I had difficulty finding it. Sometimes, even after I'd found it, I'd go to Old Ernie's Bar, Catalina, at night, and then I had trouble finding my boat. I would end up under picnic benches and things like that. I had a terrible time. I had the opportunity a year ago to find out what paradise was like. I finally got realistic, and having had this terrible fear of flying removed, I thought, I'm going to go down to the South Seas, and I'm going to see what paradise is really like. So realizing that was a very long sail, I took an airplane. I went there all by myself, and I arrived, and sure enough, the beaches were beautiful, and I was staying on the island of Tahiti looking over toward Moorea, and I looked through the palm trees, and I thought, this is really paradise. This is really paradise. And I kept repeating that, but then all I could think about was, this is Monday, and my Monday stag is tonight, and I'm not there. And I started worrying about that. But I stayed. I'd gone all that way, and I went around to many of the islands that I had dreamed of visiting. I went from Tahiti. I went to Raiatea and Huaheine and Bora Bora and Moorea. And those were the islands of romance that I had always dreamed of, and they were just beautiful, and the people were friendly. And I spent all my time sitting under a palm tree reading the big book. And I stayed the 16 days I'd intended to stay. I came home. Two of my friends from the Monday Stag met me at the airport. I was so happy to see them. And when I got home, I realized that I had not gone to paradise. I had gone from paradise. And it was one more time that I realized that my situation wherever I am is very, very happy. And I really enjoy being in the Laguna Beach area. And I enjoy all the friends that I have there. And I don't have to go to some desert island and sit under a palm tree to find happiness or paradise. And I have it wherever I am. Just as tonight, I'm extremely comfortable being here with you folks. I will be more comfortable in a short time. But this is, if I had my choice of what I could be doing tonight, this is what I would be doing. And that's a very comfortable feeling, but I never could achieve that feeling. And nor did I ever find any way to get to paradise with my boat. So I didn't know what to do. But it finally just reached a point where I didn't want to live on the boat anymore. I was tired of old buildings, and I wanted to do something worthwhile with my life. Everybody else seemed to be doing things that were very beneficial for society, and all I was doing was partying. So I went down and visited some friends in Laguna Beach. And in 1968, Laguna Beach was undergoing a tremendous trial, which I don't know whether you heard about in Nebraska, but they had an invasion of hippies. If anybody does not know what a hippie is, a hippie was a person with very long hair and wore tapestry shirts and sort of bizarre clothing. And they had a way of life that revolved around the use of Red Mountain wine and state-of-the-art drugs. And so they had invaded Laguna Beach, and all of a sudden Laguna Beach was not a happy little tourist town. It was supposedly a hippie drug center, and all the tourists were staying away. And I knew what hippies were like, because some hippies had stolen a sailboat from a friend of mine, I was there when it was retrieved, and one of them was chained to the shrouds when I came on board. He took a look at me, and he said, "Hey, mister, I'll shine your head for a quarter." Now, of course, with the progress that has taken place since today, it would have been a dollar. But nevertheless, I didn't think that was funny. So when the people in Laguna said that the town was overrun with these hippies, I said, "Is there anything I can do?" And they said, "Yes, you've converted a number of buildings to senior citizen centers. We have a hotel here that is producing these hippies." And I said, "No, that can't be." And they said, "Yes, it's producing them. And maybe you can buy it and do something else with the building." So I drove by, and they were right. There were hippies coming out every opening. And it said, "Smoke it," on the side of the building. And there was kind of a mushroom cloud hanging over the building. And I asked the police what they thought of the building, and they said they had a substation there. I decided that's what I was going to do. I was going to buy this building. I was going to evict these people and turn it into a senior citizen center, and I would be citizen of the year in Laguna. And 99.9% of the people in Laguna were behind me, and the police department, the fire department, the building department, the health department, the mayor, the chamber of commerce, everybody thought that I was the greatest hero to ever come to Laguna Beach. And there was an article in the newspaper. I took this thing very seriously, so when the escrow closed, I moved in this building. It had 52 rooms and heaven knows how many hippies, but, you know, 100 and some, and I had them gather in the lobby, and I thought, finally, I'm doing something worthwhile. And as I addressed this group of hippies, I thought, you know, it's a far, far better thing I do tonight than I've ever done before, was the way I was thinking. And I said that law and order has come to Laguna Beach, and they were all going to have to move, and I was not going to put up with any nonsense. So I told them they all had to move by the next day, and I suddenly felt very self-righteous, and I thought, at last, I'm doing something worthwhile. 2 hours later, I was up in someone's room smoking pot. Well, I started talking to these kids, asking them where they would move, and they said they had no place to move because they didn't know how to get a house with a picket fence, and they didn't know about 9-to-5 jobs, and they couldn't get along in society, and they were just kind of all clinging together in this little outpost because they couldn't get along in the world at large. And I thought, for heaven's sakes, I'm a hippie. I was a little old, and I certainly had the wrong hairstyle, but I finally found a home. I not only found a home, but I found a group of people that I could talk about my feelings with. And we shared our feelings and some of our activities, and one person said that he just couldn't handle authority and he had hated gym class, and I knew from that point on that I was in the right place. So I just moved in and stayed for 5 years. I would say that by this time, 99.9% of the people in Laguna not only hated the building, they also hated me. And but I was very determined, and I ended up with some determination that I don't know whether it comes from just being stubborn or being an alcoholic, but the more people told me that we had to close the building, we had to get rid of those hippies, the more I said, "No, this is my family." And they said, "It's like the Manson family." And but I said, "Well, we're all helping each other. It's like a halfway house." And everyone said, "Yes, but which way are they going?" And I stayed there, and I developed some close friends. And the interesting thing is that when I was there, we were all searching for truth. Of course, we were searching for truth with various commodities and Red Mountain wine. But we thought we would have spiritual experiences as a result of this. And that's what we were looking for, some sort of a spiritual experience. We were looking for brotherhood. We were looking for love and companionship and honesty. And those are all of the traits that I have since found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea that that was something that would develop as a result of being sober. And a lot of the kids that were at that hotel are now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's really a joy to see them, and we all get together. And the building inspector also joined Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about the old times in that hotel, and every time I see another kid from there come into a meeting, I'm so glad because I think, there's somebody else in the family who's safe. And something happened with those kids, and that is I developed a feeling of love for those kids because I felt like their father. I felt like everybody's father. And I had never felt that kind of love for anyone else or that kind of closeness with anyone. So it was kind of with reluctance that I finally got very tired of being a hippie landlord, and I sold the building. And things got a lot worse for me at that time. As my drinking increased, trying to take care of a building full of hippies was a full-time job. But later people said, well, you've done all that. Why don't you just kind of take it easy for a while and think about yourself for a change? And that was a very great mistake, because the more I thought about myself, the more I thought, you're a total failure. You've never done anything worthwhile in your life. You're not even married. You don't have a family. You even failed as a hippie. What is left? So the only thing that seemed to be left was to drink, and that's when my drinking progressed rapidly, and I started having these terrible blackouts, and I would end up 50 miles from where I last remembered being, and I realized that I had been driving a car in a blackout on the freeway. And every time I pick up a newspaper and read about someone who's had a head-on collision going the wrong way on a freeway, I just shudder, because I think that I could have done that extremely easily, and someone was looking after me, or that certainly would have happened to me. But terrible things started happening, and during a blackout one night, I got into some altercation at a not too high-class bar in Laguna Beach, and the next day I woke up and I was home, and I didn't know what happened. I didn't know how I got home. I had started off the evening just with the intention of taking my dog down to the beach to run him on the beach for a few minutes, and I parked the car with the dog in it by the Sandpiper Bar, and I told the dog that I would be back in just a minute to run him on the beach, but I was going to go in for a quick beer. And I went in for a quick beer, and I saw some friends and had some more quick beers, and then we started drinking Boilermakers. And the next day, I woke up just feeling terrible, looking around the house. I found my dog. My car was not home, but I figured, well, I was home, the dog was home. Two out of three wasn't too bad at that time. And in finding my car, I also found the story that had taken place. And I don't know why this upset me so, but the two people that owned the bar had to ask my friends to take me out of there before I got hurt, because I was walking up to a young lady and asking her why she was dancing with such an ugly gorilla. And when I learned that, I said, well, what did the ugly gorilla do? You know, because I expected my nose to be broken. And they said, well, all the ugly gorilla did was just shake his head and ask the bartender to come over and please get this man out of there before the poor old drunk got hurt. And I had never intended to be a poor old drunk, and that was very humiliating to me, and I have not been back to the Sandpiper since, as a matter of fact. And the interesting thing is, even though it's been quite a few years since I've been in the Sandpiper, none of my close friends that I always used to drink with have ever called. No one has ever said, why did you come back to the Sandpiper? And yet, if I miss a meeting that I normally attend of AA the next day, numerous people call and say, where were you last night? And that seems to be the difference between the friends I have today and the friends that I had at the Sandpiper. But I didn't want to go on having these humiliating experiences. And then someone told me that there was a magic substance called cocaine that prevented blackouts. Well, I had not known anything about cocaine when I was a hippie. I mean, we were trying to be very organic. And somehow cocaine didn't seem organic. But anyway, I tried some, and they were right. It prevented blackouts. And in fact, sometimes it prevented them for several days in a row. But then I think I did that like any typical alcoholic would. Very soon I had a problem with that, too. And I had financial problems anyway as a result of being a hippie. I still had a few buildings left. But in getting into this new activity, I discovered a formula for converting stucco buildings to white powder. And so it was kind of a toss-up as to what was going to happen first, whether I was going to die or run out of stucco buildings first. And it was close all the way to the end. But what finally happened was that I just could not drink anymore, and I could not do anything anymore. By this time, I was hyperventilating as a way of life, and I had reached a point where every time I tried to drink, I would have this terrible pain in my back and the pain in my side, and I was losing all contact with reality. And I didn't realize how much contact I had lost with reality until I began to get sober. And after I was sober for a while, people started telling me what they had thought when I first arrived at AA. And they said, you know, we had thought you were probably one of those who had just gone a little bit too far. And I really was. I think I was one that had gone a little bit too far. And I'm just so grateful for everybody in AA who kind of held me together. I thought that it was an accident that brought me to my first meeting, but it was no accident, I realize today. I was in very, very bad shape. I just couldn't take care of myself. I couldn't even function as a human being. And one of my friends stopped drinking and then got so sick that he ended up in a hospital unit. And as part of being in this hospital, they went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew that there was still an Alcoholics Anonymous around because a lady about 5 years before that had met me at a dinner place one night and had told me that she was an alcoholic and been sober a number of years. And I didn't know why she was telling me that at that time. But I still remember that that lady was very happy, and she's still very happy, and she now has 40 years of sobriety. But she's the first person who ever told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was very encouraging to me, because I thought, well, I know one person that goes, and she's very happy, so maybe it won't be so bad. And somehow I made it from my house to the hospital to go to this AA meeting, and I had no idea what it was going to be like. I figured they'd turn out all the lights and show movies of diseased livers and head-on collisions, things like that. I had no idea the same people would be there that are here tonight. They were all happy, and they were hugging each other, and they were so happy. And when I first walked in, I thought I was at a meeting for the family of the alcoholics. I had no idea that these people were drugs like myself. And I just thought I was very different, and I didn't think that I would ever be able to stay sober comfortably or do the things they were doing. But there was a very definite attraction in that room, and I wanted what those people had. And for the first time in a very long time, I felt safe. Somehow being in that meeting, I just felt safe. So I sat in the back of the room, and I started listening to what people had to say. And one of the first speakers I ever heard was Norm A., who was a very popular speaker in our area, who is no longer with us, but we always think of him frequently. I always do, because in his talk, in which he said, probably told a two-hour talk in about 45 minutes. He had so much to say. But he started talking about getting sick in his car and then wishing he'd rolled the window down first. And I started laughing because I had done the same thing. And I started laughing, and I thought, you know, this is amazing. It's the first time in a great many years that I had found anything to laugh about. And here I was laughing. All the fun I'd been having previously had been very serious business. And I also made a discovery, and that is that you can't laugh and hyperventilate at the same time. So this was very important. And at one of the first meetings, David Yu, who is still a friend of mine, stood up and started talking about anxiety attacks. And I had no idea what an anxiety attack was. I just thought that I should be institutionalized. I didn't know what was wrong. And he talked about this stark raving terror that he had. And when he'd gotten sober, he'd reached a point where he was just paralyzed with fear. And he talked about these feelings of always feeling you're at the top of a 2,000-foot cliff, and if you move even half an inch, you're going to fall off the cliff. And I thought, that's just the way I feel all the time. And I went up and I spoke to him after the meeting and said, you're the first person who has ever told me about those feelings. And he talked with me for a while, and he said that he had gone through all sorts of different programs, and he'd been in institutions. But the way he had gotten through those feelings and the way he had learned to be a functioning member of society and able to go to the grocery store and all those freedoms was through staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was from him that I decided that there was a way for me to recover, and that it was through going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to my friend who I had met many years before at this dinner, and I said, Ina, here I am. I am an alcoholic. Now, Ina did not seem terribly surprised. In fact, she seemed kind of relieved. But I said, now that I am here and I found the right place, how do you join? And she said, you take out ashtrays. So I thought, well, that's cryptic, but I started doing it. Because at that point, for the first time in my life, I was willing to follow any directions that anyone gave. And I thought, if it will help at all. So I started taking out ashtrays, and I went to meetings early and set up meetings. And sometimes if there were 200 people in a meeting, I would be too frightened to go in and sit down. But if I went early and there were three people and two coffee pots, I could handle that. And as I made the coffee, people would come in gradually, and then I would overcome some of this fear. And so I started leading a much more comfortable life through Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ina also told me that I would have to find a sponsor. I said, how do you do that? And she said, you'll know your sponsor when you meet him. And this was also very cryptic, but then
I've been going to a Tuesday step study, and my friend Tom, whom I did not know at that time, was always at that Tuesday step study, and always cheerful, and he laughed a lot, and I wanted what he had, and he was very sincere about the program. I could see that he walked like he talked, which is a very, very accurate appraisal of Tom's life, and so I asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he said, well, first he wanted to talk over a few things, and he wanted to know whether I was really an alcoholic, and so I started talking, and I had just spoken with him for a few minutes, and he said that he didn't like to judge, and no one else could really tell you whether or not you were an alcoholic or not, but he wanted to assure me that I was in the right room. And I was very relieved, because I had thought that I had had so many mental problems that I wasn't sure that I was just a garden variety alcoholic, and I was really happy to find that that's exactly what I am. I am just another garden variety drunk, and that feels good today. I never thought it would feel good to just feel that I was just an average anything, and I'm really glad to be right in the middle of the group, because I knew that there was a program of recovery for us poor garden variety drunks, and I feel very, very lucky to feel that way, and things started getting better. I had a lot of remorse about having been wealthier at one time and not very secure financially at this time, and I had a lot of other problems to work through in trying to work the steps. I was told that I would have to communicate with the federal government and explain why I had discontinued my communications with them for a few years. I sent some back forms with an explanation that I had had a continuing illness. And so I got through that, and I started feeling better, and I got acquainted with a lot of the people in the Laguna area, and Chuck C. was living up on the hill, and I was able to go and talk to him, which was a very great privilege, and I began to realize that my life was getting better, and it was not something that I had to do. It was something that would happen as a result of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to work the steps. And like many, many other people in our group, I would sit out on his terrace, and Chuck would point to his bougainvillea, and he would say, you know, that's a very happy bougainvillea. Do you know why it's happy? And I would say, no. And he said, it's happy because it wants to be a bougainvillea. It doesn't want to be an orchid, and it doesn't want to be a rose. It's very happy just being a bougainvillea. And God has given it everything necessary to be a happy, contented bougainvillea. And I thought, yes, I think that's true. And then a little bird came by, and he said, you know, that's a very happy little hummingbird. And do you know why it's a happy little hummingbird? And I already was getting the idea. And I said, yes, because it doesn't want to be a hawk or an eagle. And he said, that's right. It just wants to be a hummingbird. And God has given it everything necessary to be a happy little hummingbird. And he said, do you think that there is any reason in the wide world that God has not given you everything that is necessary to be a happy person today, if only you will try to do God's will and try, such as the hummingbird and the bougainvillea. If a bougainvillea and a hummingbird can do it, so can you. And that started giving me some hope. So I got more active in meetings, and I thought, this is working out very well. And I started developing a lot of friends in the area. I got rid of some of that enormous guilt that I've been carrying around. I was told that I would have to do an inventory, and as a result of that, do a fifth step, which I did with my sponsor. And I had written down all of these things in my inventory, which I was never going to tell another human being. And you can imagine the very deep secrets I had. I'm afraid it was a very dull inventory, things like being the worst kid in gym class, which I had never told anybody. I don't think I even told the Irish setter about that. And I had written all of these things down, and then I wrote them down with the idea I was never going to tell anybody. And I kept it locked up in my house. It was locked up in a desk, which was sort of unusual because I lived alone. But I, a burglar might have read it. And so I eventually got around to sharing it with my sponsor, and he said I could read it to him on the way to Fullerton, which was about 20 miles away where he was speaking that night. So I read it to him on the way to Fullerton. I read it to him on the way back from Fullerton. We got to my house. He refused to come in the house because he thought he would never get away. And we sat there and went over this for several hours more, and it seemed to go on and on. And I finally finished, much to the relief of my sponsor. And he listened very intently and shared a lot of his experiences with me, and we felt very close that evening. But by the end of the evening, he said, "You know, I can already detect one underlying character defect that you have that you're going to have to work on, which has probably affected your life." And I said, "Oh," I was very worried about it, and I thought, "I probably am going to have to be institutionalized after all." Said, well, what is that? He said, "You talk too much." That's one reason I keep looking at my watch. I don't want to make that mistake tonight. But that was an enormous relief, because all of a sudden I realized that I was repairable. I had not really been positive of that before. But rather than having all these notions of guilt and remorse and sadness that I had, I knew that there were specific character defects that I had and difficulties that I had. And as a result of that, there was something I could do about it to get better. And I didn't even have to do it. I just had to be willing to have God do this. And at that point, I was perfectly willing to turn all of these defects of character over to God. Now, from time to time, I take them back again until there's total agony. And then once again, I turn them back over to God, thinking, no, that's enough of that. But I did find a formula for trying to live. And I've been very grateful for that. I thought, well, this is all going well. And I was starting to lead a comfortable life. And I thought, this is a wonderful way of life, but what would happen if I had some sort of difficulty to go through? And I never should have thought about that, because that question was answered immediately. About 4.5 years ago, I developed an illness, and I had some symptoms that disturbed me a great deal. If I had been drinking at that time, there would have been a very simple solution. I would have changed brands, that's all. But instead, I went to see a doctor, and I described these symptoms to the doctor, and who said it was probably nothing, but we'd have some tests. Well, we had some tests, and then we had some more tests, and then we had an operation. So after this operation, which was a simple, fairly routine operation at the time, it seemed like, he came into my room, and he had a very gloomy look. And I said, "Doctor, I can see that you do not have good news." And he said, "No, our surgery has indicated that you have cancer." And I said, "Well, I'm an honest, sincere human being. I'm an adult member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I deal with the truth on a daily basis. I want to know the truth. What does this mean?" And he said, "Well, it may mean that you're going to die in a couple months." And I thought, well, I didn't mean that honest. You know? There could have been some other way that he could have worded that. And but he said that possibly I would be able to have another operation which would cure this problem, but I'd have to have more tests. So I went through a whole series of tests that so many of the people in our group have gone through, and I had radioactive isotopes and CAT scans and heaven knows what all. I had so many tests that I could open a garage door walking by it. But as a result of all these tests, they said that I was going to... they had scheduled me for surgery again, and there was going to be a very long operation, but that was the only chance I had for leading a healthy life. And I just went into a panic, and I called my sponsor, and I said, "How does a person who can't go through the frozen food section at Albertsons very well get through an 8-hour operation?" And he said, "Well, you don't have to have any courage, you just have to show up." But I said, "Oh, I can do that." Yeah. So that's what I did. And but I didn't do it without any help. In fact, it took everybody at AA in our area to get me back to that hospital again. Before going to the hospital, the night before I went back to the hospital, Tom and his wife Colleen had a very nice buffet supper up at their house for me, which I considered kind of a last supper. And it was a very polite, uplifting affair. But just as we were all ready to go home, my friend Lynn W. turned to me and he said, "Bill, we all know that you're going to the hospital tomorrow. We know that that surgery is going to be successful. We have no worries about it at all. It's going to be fine." And then he turned around to everyone else and he said, "But while you're here, I want to tell you, I scheduled a memorial service for Bill next Sunday at 2 o'clock. They said there's no hope." And so I started laughing. And when I started laughing, everybody started laughing. And I think we must have the only group on earth that can take the power out of cancer through laughter, because I've had so many other friends that have gone through cancer, and we've lost several friends recently to cancer, but it has always been that we've done this together, and we've hung on to each other, and we've learned how to face things with a dignity that I never knew before. But I was so glad that we finally got to laugh about things, and as a result of probably that supper and laughing about it, I got back to the hospital, and I had to sit there for several days, or lie there for several days prior to surgery. And to show that this thing really does work, the doctor came into my office, or into my room, which seemed like his office. He was there so often, and he wanted to take my blood pressure. And this was a cardiologist who had examined me when I first got sober. And when I first got sober, I had very high blood pressure. I had an irregular heartbeat. And he wanted to see my chances of survival, I guess, when he was doing these tests. And he said, this is remarkable. Your blood pressure is normal and your heartbeat is normal. He said, what sort of medication do they have you on? And I said, well, I haven't had any medication. I told everybody I was Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't want to have anything unnecessary. So they said, well, unless I was very uncomfortable, they wouldn't give me anything. So I haven't had anything. And he said, well, then how can you sit here the day before major surgery and be as calm as you are? And I said, well, doctor, you don't understand. I don't have to do anything. I just had to show up. You know, it's the doctors that have to do the surgery. I'm not even going to be awake. If I were you, I'd check them. And, so the doctor looked at me with a very confused look, and he said, you know, you people in Alcoholics Anonymous are all the same, and he walked out. And that night I had told the nurses that I would have several family members stopping by, and they did, and all my family members, of course, are in AA. And when they were leaving, which was about 10 o'clock that night, they stayed a little late, and they were walking out of the room, and my friend Lynn turned around and looked at all the flowers in the room. And he said, I want you to water those suckers tonight because we're not going to buy new ones for your service. And so, the nurse came in afterwards to see what we've been laughing about. And she said, what on earth were you laughing about? And I told her. And she said, you know, you have a large family, but they're very strange. And so the interesting thing, too, is that when I went into the hospital, they asked who my two closest relatives were, who I should notify, or who they should notify if I had problems. And I put down my sponsor, Tom, and my friend, David H., with whom I had gotten sober, as my two closest relatives. And also, I signed a statement that I wanted to be unplugged from any life-saving machines if I ended up in a hopeless state, because I already knew from previous years of my life what it was like to live like a vegetable, and I did not want to be a vegetable again. So I had given Tom and David the power to have the plug pulled if I seemed hopeless. And I don't know if that was a good idea or not, because every time Tom came to see me and I came up with one of my jokes for the day, Tom would rush off looking for a nurse, mumbling something about he's hopeless, unplug him. And, but I wasn't even plugged in, so I don't know. But the obvious thing is that I did get through the surgery, and I have had a very happy life since then. I was very, very happy that the doctor explained to me that when I woke up, I would be in intensive care. And I was glad that he told me that, because otherwise I would have been very worried. Because the first thing I knew, I woke up after the surgery, and I was in intensive care, and there were tubes and wires and quickly things that looked like something out of a TV movie. And the only thing that I was really aware of was that this doctor was looking over me, and also I noticed that Tom and David were in the intensive care room. They had been at the hospital during surgery, and when they say that we don't have to do anything alone in this group, they mean it literally, because I did not have to go through any of that illness alone. And when other people in our group have gone through illness, we've always made it a point to be sure that they are not alone. And so I realized I was not alone, but here was this doctor looking down at me, and he said, well, who am I and where are you? And I looked at him, and I said, well, you're Dr. Young, and this is South Coast Hospital. he said, well, that's right. And you seem to be conscious now, and you've come through your surgery all right. We think you're going to recover. And he told Tom and David that they could come and say a few words to me, and they wanted to know how I was doing. And I said, well, I'm doing better than the doctor. He doesn't even know who he is. So Tom and David just looked at each other and said, he's okay, and they went home. And and I was okay, and I'm still okay. And I have learned in our group that we can get through anything as long as we stay close to each other. And we've had really good times, and we've had really bad times. And we've had moments of hope and moments of despair. But I know that whatever we have to go through, we do it with each other. And I know that as long as I stay close to you folks and continue to work the steps as I'm trying to do today, and stay very, very close to all of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that no matter what I have to go through, I can do it with dignity. I love you all very much. All right. Thank you.